Accession number 28654, Mr. Leslie Gilbert, Reel 1. Can you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Gilbert?
I was born in September 1920, somewhere in the East End of London. I'm not sure where. My family's Jewish. My father at that time owned a shoe shop. One of my early memories, which you'll discover is quite relevant, is when I was about four. I had an uncle who was very keen on scientific and technical things, and I remember he had an early radio. This would have been only about 2 years after the British Broadcasting Company was set up, and he had a radio which consisted of the small room of the house full of equipment and a horn loudspeaker. It was these old HMV dog listening type things at the top of the stairs, so that the sound, the music, could be broadcast all over the house. And I went around in the room, I can remember this, and started pulling off wires and twiddling knobs, and instead of him bashing me, he just showed me how to put things together again. And when I was about nine or ten, he took me to the Science Museum. And that really started me off. After that, I saved up my pennies, and whenever I could, I'd go down by bus to South Kent and look at the stuff in the Science Museum. We were very poor. My father went bankrupt in about 1930, and after that he was unemployed, and we were very poor. I'll come back to this in a moment.
Now, whereabouts in East London were you? I know you're not sure where you were born, but where were we living?
I don't know. Roughly the Whitechapel area, where all the Jews lived. I remember the lane being talked about. I don't know whether it's Brick Lane or whatever, but
the Whitechapel area.
The Whitechapel area, yes.
Now, you said, tell us a bit about your childhood then. What was it? I mean, early interest in wireless aside, what was it actually like growing up in a fairly poor, circumstance? From the time you were eight, you were in fairly poor, ten rather, you were in fairly poor.
It was bad. It was rough. We never had any holidays, never went anywhere. I remember on one occasion, my father, who was, a mild kind of person, saying to me at one of the meal times, "Don't take so much butter." Things like chicken were a real treat. I think they were to a lot of people in those days. They weren't dead cheap the way they are now. And altogether, it was not at all pleasant. One couldn't really afford anything at all. What helped was the fact that my grandparents on my mother's side were reasonably well off. They were the parents of that uncle I referred to. And they used to help. I think without their help, the family might have just sunk.
What was your accommodation like? Were you in a flat or rooms?
Well, first of all, this shoe shop was in Kentish Town, and we lived over the shop. I can remember one night when I'd gone to bed. I suppose I must only have been about five at the time, and it was still sunny, must have been summer, daylight, and there was a bang, and I looked outside, and Kentish Town High Road at that time had trams, and a motorcyclist with a pinion rider had crashed head-on into the tram. And there was blood all over the place. Sand was scattered on it. And still, when I see sand in the road, I have an immediate flashback to that, and I think there must be blood underneath it. We moved to Cricklewood. We moved around. Every time my grandparents moved, we moved, because my mother wanted to be near her mother, I think.
So you moved from Whitechapel to Cricklewood?
No, from Whitechapel to Kentish Down.
Right, sorry, yes.
Kentish Down, then to Upper Clapton, and at that time I was attending some kind of a so-called private school. It was a small group of boys in the front room of a house, an ordinary house, in one of the local roads. That must have been before my father went bust. Then we moved to Cricklewood, and I went to what was called an elementary school. Now, this is quite relevant to my future once again. Boys only, girls in a separate school. the boys 40 in a class, the school leaving age was 14, but at age 11 you took an exam called the scholarship exam, the precursor of the later 11 plus. I took this exam, it must have been that if you passed it you went to a grammar school. It was probably in about 1931-32, at the time of a very serious slump in this country, terrible slump economically. The headmaster came in with the results and he said, well boys, you know there are 40 in the class, 12 of you have passed, and he read out the list of names. I think I was third or fourth. He then said, but you all know the terrible economic situation we're in now, don't you? Yes, sir. Well, only four of you are going to grammar school. I happen to be one of the four, and I've always wondered what happened to the other eight. That led me to go to Kilburn Grammar School, which was the nearest grammar school to Cricklewood, and then I was away.
What do you remember of your education at Kilburn Grammar School? What type of school was it? What was your education?
Oh, it was formal. You worked hard. The boys, on the whole, were very keen. I was put into, I suppose it was the, so there was a, it was streamed, although they didn't call it streaming. And because of my birthday, it was a bit awkward which stream to put me in, apparently. I was put in the B stream, which did Latin. I wanted to do physics and chemistry, which was A stream. So one day I went to the headmaster and asked to be changed over. And he said he'd never had such a request in his life for a boy to come and ask to be switched. Why do you want to be switched? I want to do chemistry. Oh, well, you'd better be good. I used to come top, and I've still got upstairs a prize that was given to me for coming top in chemistry and physics. The physics master was extremely good. They were all ex-servicemen from the First War. The chemistry man had lost one eye and had a glass eye, which meant when he tried to pour a liquid from a bottle into a test tube, most of it would go on the floor because he had no stereoscopic vision. The geography master, and I was very good at geography, had been gassed, and every now and again he got a terrible fit of coughing, had to leave the room, obviously went off to the staff room for about 10 minutes. You could hear him coming back again later on. Nobody played up at all while he was out of the room. There was a lot of respect for these masters. The discipline was good, but not unpleasant. On one occasion, while we were at playtime, I went into the corridor from the playground into the school, and I pressed the bell that meant you all had to go in, end of playtime. And I was taken in front of the headmaster, who wanted to know why I'd done it. And I said, I don't know, sir. My finger went out and I pressed it. And he let me off.
You were concentrating on the science side, yes, of things there.
Yes, although I was quite an all-rounder. I was very good at geography. I was good at English. I can still write essays and praises that a lot of younger people obviously can't do. I obviously learnt my grammar and I learnt my spelling, which not everybody these days is very good at. Now,
what about sport? Were you interested in sport?
I wasn't much good at sport. Cricket, yes, but not football, and not some horror that we had once a year, which was to go long distance running round Hampstead Heath. I was good at sprinting, but long distance running was not my scene at all. So I wasn't really much of a sportsman, although in those days one was out of doors virtually all the time. When I lived in Cricklewood, there was a park just down the road, and we used to go and play there till it was dusk. Of course, in those days, you just wandered around as you wished. And it's led to me being active right through my life. This morning, for example, knowing you were coming this afternoon, I made sure I went out for a long walk.
Now, what about OTC? Was there any officers training corps at Kilburn Hunt Grammar School?
I can't remember that at all, no.
What about outside of any hobbies outside?
Oh yes.
I mean, I come to wireless, and I think that's probably going to. Did you have any? Were you Boy Scouts or anything like that?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't clubby. I had a very strong hobby in chemistry, and I did the most crazy things in chemistry. And
what kind of things?
Well,
this is at home, you mean?
Yes. For example, I used to make an explosive, which was very dangerous, and I refused to disclose the formula to my son when I told him about it later on. And somehow or other, I got hold of one of these ancient pistols, flintlock pistols, and I filled it with powder and rammed the stuff in. And then I thought, maybe I shouldn't fire this, just in case. So I took it to the end of the garden, tied it to an apple tree, put a string on the trigger, came right up top, pulled the trigger, the gun blew to pieces. If I hadn't done that, probably I wouldn't be here now. That kind of thing I used to do. Also, photography was an extremely powerful hobby of mine, and still is, and it's led to a lot of art appreciation, I think. I learned how to appreciate pictures.
Well, did you have your own camera? And photography there often involved developing. I mean, people who are interested
yes.
tended to take their interest right through rather than just take it to a chemist. Was that the case with you?
I even made my own photographic paper. And jumping ahead a little bit here, when I was later on, when I was about 19, I suppose, we were living in Putney. And by that time, I was able to spend a bit of money on a camera, not too much, but money, and I lusted after a particular second-hand camera that I could see in a local shop window. And I went in and talked to the shopkeeper about it, and I hummed and hawed because, to me, it was very expensive. And eventually he said, look, why don't you give me a deposit? Take it away over the weekend, shoot some film, bring it back, I'll develop it, and then you can decide. So, okay, I went off on my cycle. I used to cycle a great deal, and I found myself on London Bridge, facing Tower Bridge. It was a nice bright day, and between the two bridges in those days, there were lots of ships. It was the Pool of London. So I very carefully started setting up my camera to take a picture. I felt a tap on my shoulder. I felt a tap on my shoulder. I looked round and there was a man there, and he said, don't you know you're not supposed to take photographs of shipping? And I don't know whether I knew or not, but anyway, I told him, using certain language, to go away, and I continued. I think I took a photograph and I was taking another one. Felt another tap on my shoulder. I said, didn't I tell you to go away? A nasty voice replied, and it was a policeman. Marched me off to the local police station, confiscated the film, gave me back the camera, told me I would hear from them. At that time, I was in the Communist Party, and I thought, there's going to be a lot of trouble here. I got home, and I put all my communist books up in the loft, as though the police would never search the loft, you see. On the Monday morning, I was sent for by the man in charge of the office where I was working, which was an Inland Revenue office. I went in the Inland Revenue, and he told me the police had been inquiring about me, but of course I had a clean record. I mean, I was all right in that respect. The police sent for me. They showed me the photograph I'd taken, which was, although I say it myself, beautiful. Every detail of every ship was visible. They gave me a talking to us, sent me off. I'd taken another photograph in rather crazy circumstances a few years earlier when I was still at school. There was a cruise once a year. We went, it cost, I think, £5 for a fortnight cruising. And I kept pestering my parents to let me go. For a couple of years, they wouldn't because they didn't have the money. But eventually they okayed it, and the ship went around the Baltic, Stockholm, Helsinki, Oslo, came back through the Kiel Canal, stopped at Kiel off the ship for a bit of exercise. I wandered around the docks and I saw one of the German pocket battleships and I photographed that. And once again, it's just as well authority wasn't there, because if they were, I wouldn't be here now. That was a photograph I sent in. You may know the government asked people during the war to send in any photographs they'd taken abroad. So they had a photo, not very good photograph of one of the German pocket battleships.
Now, so photography and chemistry were your main hobbies. What about wireless? Was that still a hobby of yours?
Oh yes. I used to make crystal sets to begin with, and then valve wirelesses, as we called them. Yes. And when I eventually joined the RAF...
Hang on. Now, let's go back to your school. You were there from 1931 to what age?
One left at 16. You could leave at 16 after taking what was called matriculation, and then you went into the sixth form, which in those days was a real sixth form, to take what was called inter BSc, which led to university. But because my father was unemployed, it was very difficult for me to go to university, and I decided, well, it was decided really for me, that I was going to go out to work, and in the civil service, because there was a guaranteed pension.
What was your job? You mentioned in...
I went in the Inland Revenue. Now, here is something rather sad, because near where we lived in Cricklewood, and I think the remnants are still there, there was the Post Office Research Station. That is where I wanted to go. And if I'd gone there, I would have been, I believe, a student apprentice, and I would have been sent one day a week in order to take an external degree. The pay was 30 shillings a week. In the Inland Revenue, it was 32 and sixpence a week. And that 2 and 6 months made all the difference. And so I ended up in the Inland Revenue.
Now, what were you working as? A clerk or...?
Well, it was called a tax officer. It was clerical officer grade, but it was very high-level work, actually.
And tell us just a bit, to give us a flavour of what you'd do as a tax officer.
Well, you would assess somebody's income tax. They would complete a form giving details of themselves. You might sometimes write to them, ask them questions. Even possibly they would come in and you would work out their tax. You wouldn't collect their tax. The collection was done by a separate collection service. But you would be doing what was called assessment. I remember on one occasion I was assessing a very well-known author who lived in Highgate, because my office was in Camden Town and we covered Highgate. And I worked out his tax, and I can still remember it was about £7,800, and I was on 32 and 6 a week. And normally one just dealt with these cases, as one called them, you know, as completely routine things. But I remember sitting back and looking at this figure, £7,800 odd, and not being able to conceive even what it meant, let alone his income. This was his tax, not his income. I found it very interesting.
Which author was it, just out of interest?
Yeah.
Which author?
Which author, yes.
Do you remember his name?
J.B. Priestley. Yeah, yes. I found tax work very interesting. My wife, who was also in taxes, loathed and hated it, and so did a friend of mine, but it appealed to me. I mean, I could easily have been a lawyer, and I used to borrow law books. The inspector was very amused by this, and when I started off in the work, I wrote long letters to taxpayers, I wrote one long letter, I remember, going into all the ins and outs of the legal position, and that the inspector in charge sent for me and said, "Mr. Gilbert, we don't write letters like that. We simply say, 'Dear sir, I'm sorry that your application is refused.'" But I enjoyed it, and I was there
until the war broke out.
And I volunteered eventually.
Hang on. Just a couple more points before we move on. Now, what about your Jewish background? Were you from an observant, an Orthodox Jewish family, or from a less Orthodox? I mean, there's a whole variety of grades of Orthodoxy.
My family were slipping badly. My mother used to slip me sixpence sometimes to go out and buy some ham on the quiet. But they observed the Sabbath, the Shabbos as we called it. She lit a candle and said some prayers. I was required to go to shul, synagogue, which was conducted entirely in Hebrew, and I hadn't got the slightest idea what was going on. I was bar mitzvahed at the age of 13 odd, you know the ceremony. For that I had to learn by heart how to chant the stuff in Hebrew, which I did. But I'm not religious, I've never been religious. My grandparents were a good deal more religious. It gradually wore off. You see, my grandparents were immigrants from Lithuania. And incidentally, they left most of the family behind in Lithuania. And in 1941, when the Germans invaded Lithuania, the family was exterminated by the Lithuanians, not by the Germans, as far as one can make out.
Now, were you aware of, in your growing up, you know, of much anti-Semitism directed at you or those around you?
Oh, yes. This is why my surname is Gilbert. And my father was Goldstein, but he changed it so that it didn't sound too Jewish. I think this is rather unfortunate, looking back. My parents spoke Yiddish as well as perfect English, and they spoke Yiddish to one another when they didn't want the children to know what was being said, so they could talk in front of the children. I wanted to be assimilated. I did not want in those days to appear to be Jewish. If we were back in those days, I would not have told you I was Jewish. So I kind of closed my ear in a way to Yiddish. If I hadn't, I would have picked up German in no time. As it is, I can still, for example, watch a German film and follow quite a bit of it. So somehow or other, the language soaked into me. And I sometimes, and also I think, certainly my grandparents, apart from English and Yiddish, they also spoke Hebrew, and I think Russian, because it's Lithuania and when they lived there, was occupied by the Russians. So I grew up in a kind of multilingual atmosphere, which has influenced me ever since. I mean, I love going to another country and hearing the language, and I always make sure that I learn a bit of it before I go.
Now, when you say you're conscious of anti-Semitism, was it much directed at you, or did you just not appear Jewish to people? I mean, your name was Gilbert. Did people realise you were Jewish? If you didn't tell them,
if one told them, one would get some snide remarks. I mean, I was never subjected to any kind of physical attack. The Kilburn Grammar School that I said I went to which I won a scholarship, had a quota system. They would only accept a limited number of Jewish boys, and that would have applied to me. You see, I think there were about not more than three per class. And as it happened, in my form, all three of us at the top were Jews. One of them, at least, became quite an important person in due
course. And were you picked on at school or bullied, or verbally bullied at school?
No, I don't remember any of that, no.
Now, the other thing is your communism. Had that started to develop at school or when you started work? What was the trigger for that?
The trigger
was the family
for that
naturally left-wing or, you know, some family?
Well, my father was a little bit leftish in a way, I suppose. I remember at the time of the Czechoslovakian business where the government gave way to the Germans, my father lending me a book which he'd borrowed from the library, called Guilty Men, I think, which was about the way the British government was collaborating with the Germans. My grandfather was quite interested in current affairs, and at that time, I'm now talking about while I was at school, about 14 or 15, I used to go round to my grandparents' house almost every day after school mainly in order to be fed, because my father was out of work. And in those days, there was something on the wireless called Children's Hour, which was very good. And once a week, there was a man called Commander Campbell who gave a little talk on some aspect of current affairs. And my grandfather and I, father and I, used to listen to this, and afterwards we would discuss it together. But what really influenced me politically was the fact that my father was unemployed, and there was this tremendous unfairness economically, which was just too obvious to me. And I had this scientific kind of outlook, and I felt that things were just run in a stupid way, and everything could be done much more sensibly, properly planned, everybody be better off, and so on. And I moved towards a kind of socialism that way. I think Bernard Shaw had a book, Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism, which I read. That kind of material. But I was floundering around trying to work out my own kind of socialist philosophy. When I joined the Inland Revenue, at that time it had a very good union called the Inland Revenue Staff Federation. Callaghan was the assistant secretary.
Jim Callaghan,
yes, and had a good reputation. It set up a youth section, which I joined, and I was quite active in play readings and political discussions and so on. And this led, I didn't know at the time what was going on, to somebody in the youth movement who heard me and realized, who was a communist, and thought I was a good bet for joining the Communist Party. He started talking to me, and he lent me a book by Engels called Anti-During, which I remember wrestling with. It was very, very difficult at the time, but Marxism appealed to me as apparently well worked out and intelligent system of thinking and action. And as a result of that, I joined the Communist Party.
Now, when was that?
I suppose it was about 1940.
So after the start of the war?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, we'll come back to that then. Now, what about you followed political affairs, and you were aware of what was going on.
Yes.
I mean, what did you think of what was going on in Germany, the rise of Nazism? I mean, just generally, the fascism. How much aware of this were you at the time?
Oh, very much aware. Most of us were. You see, we were living through it. The Spanish Civil War, the initial occupation of Czechoslovakia, the eventual occupation, even earlier on than that, the Germans going into the Rhineland, I think, made some impact on me. But I think that many people in those days were quite more well aware of political matters than now, because anybody who had their eyes open could see that another war was coming. And you mustn't forget that let's take 1938, that was only 20 years after the end of the First War. The Inland Revenue Office I worked in, almost everybody there was an ex-serviceman, and virtually the only thing they talked about years after the end of the war was their wartime experiences. So one was immersed in that kind of atmosphere. One would have been surprised if the Second World War hadn't broken out.